adding to my new Bible. So, as we just kind of heard, I think this is kind of all of us in the way. You know, we live in the city of Sydney, and all of us, I think, you know, are trying to make the places that we live in a little bit better. And sometimes maybe we even, like, put our faith in people to kind of help realize that. I don't know if you've ever had this experience of, like, really wanting to see a politician voted in or maybe voted out, and almost, like, crying with relief. Like, if anyone has kind of inspired you, like Kevin 07 or Malcolm Turnbull or Julia Gillard or Scott Morrison, or maybe really none of them, maybe further back. Or maybe we look at, like, global figures occasionally, like, it's normally American, like Barack Obama or Jacinta Ardern or Donald Trump. But whoever it is, they kind of let us down because, you know, people can say lots of lovely words and then they get in and they never quite match up to the words they say. Maybe they have to compromise, or maybe things are out of their control so they have to go in a different direction, or maybe they just, like, break their promise. But we get jaded, and there is a feeling of, like, disillusionment, I think, with politics and politicians. Like, that faith is slowly eroding away. So maybe we look somewhere else and maybe think, okay, it's not politics, maybe it's the business world. Like, I'm going to find a business leader who's doing good, or maybe we'll join an organization or a business that's doing good. Maybe we'll go non-for-profit, because surely, like, non-for-profits are good. But they too can disappoint us. Sometimes the words don't quite match up to the reality. Sometimes we just see there's, like, corruption going on or things not quite right in both the business world and the non-for-profit sector. And again, we can feel a little bit of disillusionment. So then we think, religion. Religion is the good place to be, right? The church, I'm going to find, like, a good preacher, someone that kind of inspires. I'm going to get involved serving. But again, the words never quite match up to the reality. And so I'm feeling in a jaded mood. Like, maybe you start to think, like, is a better world even possible? I don't know, after last week we saw that our city is deeply divided, and in fact our country is divided, not only on whether the question is a better world possible, but, like, how do we get there? We don't even know how we might get there. Where do we turn? I want to suggest it's Isaiah that we turn to. Isaiah gives us this vision in Isaiah 60, and it starts off almost in darkness. It starts in darkness, and then there's, like, these shadowy shapes, this outline of a city kind of you can make out. And then it's like someone, like, switches a light on, and we see that this is a city. But it's kind of a strange light, because, you know, normally light is coming down and revealing. This is a light that's deep in the city. So, like, the city is glowing with this light. It's kind of like a light that seeps through the cracks in the walls, a light that's, like, making the windows glow. And it's almost like this city is sparkling, like the roofs are gleaming. It's like a rain has recently passed through. And, you know, when a rain has passed through, like, the raindrops are still, like, hanging on the trees and everything's glistening and abundant. And there's a feeling of safety and security, so much so that these people are prepared to, like, open wide their gates. No security system needed, no check that has to go through. It's, like, wide open. This is a city that is united and is prepared to welcome all these different people. So we have all these different people from all these nations kind of making their way by foot, walking towards this city. There's people carrying children and their eyes are dazzling, and there's, like, camels pulling caravans filled with gold, and then the harbour has, like, these ships coming in, and they're also laden with gold and silver. And we hear these words in Isaiah 60 verse 1. Arise, Jerusalem, let your light shine for all to see, for the glory of Yahweh rises to shine on you. Darkness as black as night covers all the nations of the earth, but the glory of Yahweh rises and appears over you. All nations will come to your light, mighty kings will come to see your radiance. Isaiah speaks of a better world, a better city. He calls it the city of God, but he also seems to link it to a real city, Jerusalem. Now, if you've been following along in Isaiah, you might have noticed that Jerusalem is talked about a lot, or sometimes Isaiah speaks about Zion. So it's basically the same thing. And Jerusalem outshines all other cities in this book. Now, it wasn't always this way. You know, once there was no city, once there was just land, once there was like a little village. Jebus lived inhabited by the Jebusites, and it grew and became a little city, probably a little town by our standards. And then King David comes and he conquers the place. He says, this is going to be my capital city for my kingdom. I'm going to rename it Jerusalem. His son Solomon then goes and builds like the temple and says the temple of God's going to be in this city. And it's said that when the temple's built, they have like a big ceremony. It's said that the Spirit of God descends, like the glory of God descends, and they describe it like this golden cloud kind of filling the temple. And it almost feels like God has made his home here. But of course, as we know in the book of Isaiah, the city gets utterly destroyed. The people are exiled. And so Isaiah gives this vision, and it's a vision of hope. It's saying the city will be rebuilt, trees are going to be replanted, people are going to return, and it's going to be even better than before. Like, yes, it's sad that the city was destroyed, but it's going to be a marvelous city next time. In fact, all these nations are going to come and declare how wonderful it is. They're going to want to be part of it. And so in the middle of things feeling very disappointing, Isaiah still says, yes, a better world is possible. So the people come, they come back to the city under Cyrus, and people say, yes, this is God at work, allowing this to happen. And they get on to the work of remaking the city, rebuilding the temple. But I wonder if a little bit of disappointment kind of seeps in, because Isaiah 60 never really happens. Like, the city doesn't start to glow with this light. The security system is never like taken down. They're never flinging open the gates. Anyone come? People aren't saying, take my wealth for free, Jerusalem. Nations aren't rushing over to see Jerusalem. In fact, Jerusalem remains a real human city. And like most real human cities, it's divided. People are divided about what a better future even looks like or how to bring it about. I don't know if you've ever like really loved a place. There's people who really like love places. I think often farmers, like, you know, they have this real heart for the land. And then often there's heartbreak. You know, when you really love a place, you often have heartbreak because you pour in all your love into this place, and yet it can be really hard. Well, I feel like that's the city of Jerusalem, because yes, it's an ordinary city, but it also has so much expectation on it, like this really heavy expectation. Today, millions of people will echo Isaiah and describe Jerusalem as a holy city. Three major religions claim it. Like, it's kind of incredible in that regard. It's an ordinary city, and yet it's the only city that has all this pressure, like all this religious focus on it. And when we look at the history of Jerusalem, we see this tug of war. So, as many of you probably know, Jerusalem was again destroyed just a few decades after Jesus. So the Romans completely decimate it. It becomes nothing. No one's living there for a time. And people kind of forget about it. And then it's not until maybe like the 4th century AD that Christians kind of rediscover it. Maybe they're reading Isaiah 60 and they're like, like the Bible's always talking about Jerusalem. Jerusalem must be important. And there grows a desire to like check out all the places Jesus lived. So they go back to Jerusalem. I mean, actually, Jesus didn't spend that much time in Jerusalem. But any place they think Jesus might have been, like up goes a church. So there's lots of church building and people remaking Jerusalem into like a Christian city. And so for Christians at this time, like Jerusalem becomes almost the center of their world. But in 638 AD, Muslim armies come in and they take over Jerusalem. And for Muslims, and they believe Muhammad was there, it's also an important site. And so they start to remake Jerusalem into their city. Part of the reason why the Crusades ends up happening is because Christians want to like take back Jerusalem. So there's several attempts, but they're never quite successful. So for hundreds and hundreds of years, Jerusalem is under Muslim rule, although even Muslim empires kind of battle it out amongst themselves. The Turkish, the Ottoman Empire rules it for a long time. And then really late into the game, the British get involved and they rule for a time. And then after World War II, such a messy time, and kind of in a messy process, the nation of Israel is formed. And in 1949, Israel, the new nation of Israel, declares that Jerusalem will be their capital city. And there's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of expectation about what this means. It feels like an act of God. There's a group of Jewish and also Christians known as Zionists who actually say, like, this must happen. This must happen. This must be fulfilled for Jews wouldn't say this, Christians would say this, for Jesus to return. And so Christians get really excited about what's happening because it feels like, you know, politics and nations are all working under God's hand, and it's almost like maybe we're at the end of times. I think most Christian Zionists, the next step, I think, is that they believe that then Jews are going to have this massive conversion experience and they're going to come to know Christ and then, you know, Jesus will return. So I'm like treading in really controversial waters here. So I'm just going to keep swimming. Because I know a lot of people really believe this. But when I look at the city of Jerusalem, it still seems like a really human city. It doesn't really seem to match these words in Isaiah 60. And so I still find myself like searching. I'm like, is this it? Is this what Isaiah was talking about? And maybe because I'm feeling jaded or I'm just getting older, I just find myself wary. I'm wary of politicians or any leader who says, like, I'm going to be the one that's going to bring in the change and then everything's going to be better. And I find myself wary of Christians who say, I know what God's will is and this is what God's will is, too swiftly. Because one of the things I've found as I've been spending time in the book of Isaiah is that it's a long game. It's a long game to a better world. The book of Isaiah is long. Like, right, you guys have been having a lot of patience here working through Isaiah. And one of the things about spending so long in a book that spans hundreds of years is that we see that things don't happen swiftly. Isaiah keeps giving these visions of hope to sustain a people who aren't seeing a lot of change straight away. And so I think one of the things actually Isaiah is teaching us is that if we want to see a better world, we're going to need to cultivate patience. And patience literally means long suffering. It's that steady, day by day faithfulness, committed to the good, committed to God, but recognizing it bears a cost, that it won't be easy. Now, I think I've said this before, I am an incredibly not patient person. And I think lots of us are because we're finite. Like, it's very easy for God, I think, to be patient because I'm like, well, you're like immortal. I've only got one life. Like, I want change now. I want things to happen now. And that, so it's very hard to practice patience. The temptation for us as people is to not be like God, to give up on God and be like, God, if you're not going to usher in something better, like, I'm just going to take control and do it myself. And so we see people doing that. Sometimes we see people focusing on the city of Jerusalem, like going, okay, I'm going to like help God along and getting things going. Or if not the city of Jerusalem, sometimes Christians will go, okay, maybe Isaiah didn't mean literally the city of Jerusalem, but it's just another location and we've got to find that location. And so Christians kind of just decide on this city or that city and then think, I'll help God along. I'll help God's kingdom come along that way. I sometimes tell lots of stories about history and you might be like, boring, what does this have to do with like now? But I think history is really important because you see often where people go wrong and the mistakes they make. And sometimes I think the desire for a better world, a very good, a very noble intention, can go horribly wrong. And maybe especially when it's not just a desire for a better world we seek, but almost like a perfect world, that things start to derail. So I want to take you to 1534. There's a man named Micaiah Hoffman who's like this wandering preacher. It's a pretty grim time, Middle Ages. There's like lots of beggars around. Most people are peasants, a lot of people in poverty. The Ottoman Empire is kind of encroaching on Europe, so there's a fear that, oh, we're going to be invaded and taken over by Muslims. I don't know how much has changed. But anyway, so there's a lot of fear. The church seems really lost. The Catholic Church, people are starting to say, is like perverted or it's lost its way or it's in darkness. So people are dividing over that. Cities are dividing. and beginning to fight over that. And there's this sense that the end is going to come soon. So Micaiah is kind of preaching that, and he links up with a few others, and they decide, it's kind of a weird location, but they decide this little city in what we now call Germany, Munster, is going to be where God is going to come. So they kind of take it, like take it over, but like not violently, like the city kind of welcomes them because people are excited. There's expectations like, okay, Christ is going to come here. So people get excited. They start to prepare themselves. Like they want a better world. They want Christ to return. And so they start off with like mass baptism. So everyone has to be re-baptized in the proper way. And of course, if you don't, you face being killed. So lots of people line up to get baptized. And then once that's done, they're like, what's the next step? Purity, purity. We need to get rid of anything that is like not right or not pure. And so one preacher, Matthias, like preaches this. There is no place in New Jerusalem for your filth, no place for the contagion of the godless, the foulness of the impious. New Jerusalem could not stand by sects and schisms. The enemies of the city must be routed and eliminated. So more rules are introduced. God's rules, of course, the city is told. Some of them are kind of appealing, maybe. Share all your possessions, so kind of following like the early Acts church, everyone's to share, to be generous. The next rule is, which I find very sad, all books are to be burned apart from the Bible. You must follow your leaders. If you don't listen to your leaders, again, you face being killed. But the leaders fight amongst themselves and some of them die because the end doesn't come. So one leader predicts a date and the end doesn't come. So a new, more radical prophet, Lydian, says, well, they got it wrong. I have the new date and you should follow me. So people rally around him. He establishes a new constitution, which is God's constitution. But then they kind of get, it gets very messy because one of the things they believe God says is that polygamy is okay. For men. So lots of men start getting wives and there's lots of sex and then there's like lots of domestic brawls because I think even, I don't know, you can share wives around and it gets very messy and lots of fights start breaking out in the city and there's lots of pressure for women, so women can't be single. That's not an option. I think they didn't have many women in the city, so every woman has to get married. Not to have sex with your husband is, again, can get you killed. And Lydian becomes, of course, king. He declares himself to be king of the city. He ends up with 16 wives living in a really nice place. And meanwhile, everyone outside the city is like, what is going on? It seems like pretty crazy in there. And so there's an attempt to kind of free the city. So they try to like use military force to get in, but they can't. So the city goes under siege. And they manage to survive for 18 months before the city finally falls. So the city of Munster is kind of an extreme example, but it's by no means the only city I could tell a story about where people have said, I'm going to bring in God's kingdom. I'm going to bring in the city of God. This is the new Jerusalem. No, this is the new Jerusalem. Just do this, and then it will happen. And it doesn't. And so I think we need to maybe change our expectations a little bit and recognize that people aren't actually going to save us. I think actually this is what Isaiah is teaching us. Like, the city of God is God at work. It's not people trying to usher in the kingdom. And so when we look for people to save us, it gets very, very messy. And there's a part of, this is not just Christians, especially in the 20th century, there was this longing for utopia, you know, longing for a better world, longing for perfection. But often that longing is coupled with this purity that kind of casts out anyone who doesn't fit that vision or anyone who disagrees. And often violence ends up getting involved. And yet when we return back to this vision of Isaiah, we see a very different vision being proposed. So let's return and listen to these words from Isaiah 60, verse 18. Violence will disappear from your land. The desolation and destruction of war will end. Salvation will surround you like city walls, and praise will be on the lips of all who enter there. No longer will you need the sun to shine by day, nor the moon to give its light by night. For Yahweh your God will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. Your sun will never set, your moon will not go down, for Yahweh will be your everlasting light. As Christians hearing these words, I think it reminds us that we need to be very slow and resist as much as possible the move towards physical violence. That's not at all how God's kingdom comes. And not just physical violence, maybe we need to be slow to resist this zeal towards purity that want to kind of cast out anyone who might disagree with us. I think that's not our responsibility. Let it go. And maybe lower our expectations of what we can do in this world. Maybe sometimes we have too grand ideas of like, I'm going to change the world. Maybe just lower a little bit. So where do we turn? I want to talk to you about one last city that fell that had a really profound impact on Christians, the city of Rome. The city of Rome was considered immortal. Rome at one point was described as an empire without end. And so in the 5th century when it fell, it was completely shocking for people. Like, it left them jaded or disappointed or like, what is going on? Like, where is God in this? Some people blamed Christians for the fall of the city. So one really famous theologian, Augustine, had to like write a response and try and help people navigate, like, what is happening in this time? Now, Augustine was living in Hippo, who's the bishop of Hippo, in North Africa, the North African coast. And he starts talking about there being two types of cities. So he says, the city of Rome, like so many other cities, is built on human ego. Right, so we build it on ourselves, we build these cities with our own strength, and then, our egos are fragile. They're a little bit insecure, so we have a lot of fear, so we have this constant need to grasp control or domination, and which leads to violence and war, because then we perceive people as enemies. And so he says, it shouldn't be a surprise that the city of Rome fell. Because when you build a city on just your ego, it's so fragile. Like, it can shatter at any moment, and it will shatter. But the city of God is different, says Augustine. So there's the cities of this world, but there's the city of God. And it kind of draws back on this city that we see in Isaiah 60, this city glowing in the darkness. And he says, this is a city that's not built by human hands. This is a city that comes from the Spirit. It's almost out of this world. And Augustine comes to the conclusion that this is a city that you can't pinpoint on a map. It's like not one physical location. For Augustine, when he looks at Isaiah, I guess he kind of sees this talk about Jerusalem as functioning as a metaphor. So you might remember earlier in Isaiah, we had like Babylon. Babylon is a real place, but Babylon also comes to stand for all the cities of the world who are kind of opposed to God. I think in a similar way, there's Jerusalem. Obviously, Jerusalem is a real place, but it becomes to stand for those who align themselves with God. And so for Augustine, he says the city of God can be found in any place. It kind of can pop up anywhere. It's when we see people being drawn to worship God. So he says to the Christians, center your lives on God, worship God, take on the values of God, humility, justice, kindness, patience. Live those out. Let the glory of God do kind of the work of drawing people into this city, into this new way of living. Christians debate then, like, what does this look like in practice? Like, how do I live now in the city? Like, how much should I advocate for change? How much do I get involved in politics? How much do I want to impress the values of God onto my city? And Christians have a range of answers there. But Augustine doesn't really answer that. I think what Augustine is trying to get to is, like, whatever you do, let's approach this with the right expectations. A scholar by the name of Christopher Matthews, kind of reflecting on Augustine, says, actually, these are words that we could kind of hear in our time, that we recognize the oscillation in ourselves, kind of between these two cities. Like, in some ways, you could say the city's almost within us. Like, we feel the temptation towards building stuff on our own egos, and then we feel the pull towards centering our lives on God. But also, Christopher Matthews would say, it helps us make sense of disappointments we might see in the world around us. And so here's a quote from him. He says, we tend to be, you're either so hopeful that you yourself and your friends can immediately change the world in radical ways, that when you get stymied or it turns out the course of history goes otherwise than you expected, you fall kind of into a pessimistic despair. His, Augustine's, thought is that politics can be a means of some genuine good, although the good that it accomplishes can never be permanent or fixed in a stable way that would secure it from any kind of slippage. Isaiah 60 can help us form the right expectations of what it's like to live in this world. Yes, we see glimmers of the city of God, but it's still the outline. We don't see it completely yet. And so as we live in this city, the city of Sydney, I think we want to be people who are trying to live out God's values. We want to be people who are humble and peacemaking and loving and just. And yet we also want to recognize that there are forces in us, inside us, and also around us, kind of pulling us in the opposite direction. So as we engage in doing good in our work and in our families and in our neighborhoods, we should be prepared that there will be disappointments and setbacks. Like, that shouldn't take us by surprise. It's part of what it means to live in this world. And so as Christians, we continue to learn, what does it mean to practice patience? What does it mean to reflect God in that long-suffering patience of continuing to pursue good in the setbacks and in the disappointments? As Christians, we keep coming back to God and recognizing it's not going to be people who will save us. Ultimately, it's God. So we keep coming back to like centering our lives on God. And as Christians, we learn to like encourage hope within us. Like we have visions like Isaiah to give us hope as communities, that even when it doesn't feel like it, a better city is still to come. The Bible ends with this vision that pretty much echoes Isaiah 60, the vision that John has on the island of Patmos in Revelation. He sees the city of God coming and the glory of God filling the city, so there's no need for sunlight. He sees tears being wiped away. He's basically quoting Isaiah 60. But there's one difference in Revelation that John adds. In the city that John sees, he sees a lamb at the center of the city. That lamb, obviously, is Jesus. And he says it's Jesus who will be the one who will usher in the new heavens and the new earth. And so as we work for good and as we seek a better world, we center ourselves on Jesus. And we kind of, in the end, are left crying out, Jesus, come. Come and let your light shine for all to see. So let me pray with that in mind. Lord Jesus, we do say come. We ask that your spirit might continue to be at work in this world, in this city, and in our lives. We ask that the city of God might be revealed in glimpses and in glimmers in our world and in our city and in our lives. Help us to be people of patience. Help us to be people of hope. Help us to be people who pursue what is good. But Lord Jesus, when we stumble and when we are disappointed, when there are setbacks, help us to fix our eyes on you. May your kingdom come and your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Amen.